Welcome to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie. On this evening's The Space Show, Australian composer Amanda Lee Falkenberg and her Moons Symphony, which celebrates the moons of our solar system. This will be episode 2, coming up right now.
Go for the moon. I want to go to the moon. Let's take a trip to the moon. Come on, let's go for the moon. I want to go to the moon. Let's take a trip to the moon.
Well, it won't be the moon on this episode, but it will be two of the moons of our solar system. Amanda Lee Falkenberg is an Australian composer. Her latest work is the Moons Symphony, which depicts in orchestral and choral terms 7 of the hundreds of the moons of our solar system. On last week's The Space Show, we introduced Amanda and described Miranda and Ganymede. This week, we visit Io and Titan. Moon names. Io. In 1610, Italian Galileo Galilei discovered 4 moons orbiting Jupiter. These were the first moons ever discovered after our own moon. Galileo called them Medici Sidera, but other astronomers refused to accept this name. In 1613, rival astronomer Simon Marius, who had claimed prior discovery, named them after 4 of the god Jupiter's illicit loves. Io, the daughter of Inachus, was changed by Jupiter into a cow to protect her from Hera's jealous wrath. The Voyager 1 and 2 spacecraft revealed Io to be the solar system's most volcanically active body, with plumes reaching altitudes of 100 kilometers above the sulfurous surface.
And now, as we launch from Spaceship Earth, we head to Jupiter to explore the most volcanic world in our solar system, Moon Io, a world scorched by fire and flame, caught in a celestial tug of war, where companion moons Europa and Ganymede pull Io in one direction, while Jupiter yanks back in the opposite. This brutal choreographic dance is responsible for Io's extreme runaway tidal heating. This first excerpt explores the Loki Patera, Io's most powerful volcano. Its power is generated by an intriguing process and described as a massive quiescent lava sea shaped like a horseshoe, which over time forms a crust, and when this reaches critical thickness, sinks into the magma, and the sea resurfaces again like a giant windshield wiper. The Loki Patera is the most powerful volcano in our solar system, producing more heat than all of Earth's volcanoes combined.
Now, during this feature, I will be reading some poems about the moons. Most of these were written by English poet Stuart Atkinson. Here's the first of these. Io, by Stuart Atkinson. A pity future Ionian cartographers, mapping that moon is futile. Sulfur spatters out of open wounds, volcanoes fighting for space like boils and sores on barren Hakonan's ruined face. Lava belching and leaking out of them to cover the leprous landscape in a creeping tidal wave of pus.
And now let's hear some of the music
the Io theme from the Moon Symphony, composed by Amanda Lee Falkenberg and played by the London Symphony Orchestra under the conductorship of Maren Alsop, with the London voices conducted by Ben Perry.
Oh,
the Io movement from the Moon's Symphony, conducted by Maren Allsop, the London Symphony Orchestra, and the conductor, the Australian Amanda Lee Falkenberg. Well, now on the Space Show, planetary scientists Linda Spilker and Ashley Davis in conversation with Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society.
I want to bring up now somebody who has been part of the Voyager mission, those emissaries to the stars, Voyager 1 and 2, maybe not quite from the start of Voyager, but was part of Voyager, left it to become the project scientist of the spectacular Cassini mission, which now has completed its mission of revelation at Saturn and is now back to being on the Voyager mission as well, the deputy project scientist for Voyager. Please welcome from the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, Linda Spilker. So, Linda, I got all that right. I'm Voyager 2, still going strong. It's Voyager 1, maybe, that's having a little difficulty right now?
Yeah, Matt, Voyager 2 is going strong. So is Voyager 1. We're still getting back good science, and the pointing looks really good. But some of the engineering data for the attitude control system looks a little strange. So we're trying to figure out what exactly is going on. Here's a spacecraft, a pair of spacecraft, that were designed to last 4 years, to fly by Jupiter and Saturn. And it's been almost 45 years, 10 times longer than their design lifetime. Every year we have 4 watts less power. We use the decay of plutonium to generate heat, and that runs the spacecraft. And so every year we have to carefully agonize, what do we turn off? What's left to turn off?
Tell me how the two of you connected over the Moon Symphony.
Well, Amanda, you want to start with Bob Poppolotta reaching out to you?
Yeah. So about 3 months into my research of Moon Europa, I kept coming across a particular individual, and I'm like, oh, this guy looks really interesting to me. And I researched him, and he's at NASA JPL, and I'm like, I'm just going to email him about my project. And so I did. I just said a simple project about my vision about these moons and how I would love it, the world premiere in Royal Albert Hall just down the road. Because I wanted to speak with someone to help me anchor this, the science of these moons in accuracy. And so it turns out he was lead scientist for the Europa Clipper mission. And he wrote back to me about 7 days later and agreed to Skype. And so we chatted about the characteristics of Moon Europa and the mission. And he was very interested in my project. He said, I think the scientists would be very interested in your symphony too, Amanda. I'm like, really? He said, oh, yes. And he mentioned Linda Spilker, and that's who connected us to the project.
Hearing about the project, I was very excited to take the moons and actually put them together with music in a way that the public could relate to. And so I invited Amanda to come to one of our project science group meetings and talk a little bit about her symphony and play some of the music. And from then on, we've been communicating and working on the science for this particular symphony.
Thank goodness. Linda's accompanied by her husband, Tom Spilker, who is as experienced, stand up, Tom, as experienced at JPL. Another very accomplished scientist and engineer, because now he's figuring out how to build us a space station worthy of what you saw in 2001. I don't know about you, but I want to visit. Linda, address just very quickly how cameras not just have connected us to these missions by delivering these beautiful images, but to the science as well.
Well, it's so incredible, these missions. When we go out, we were thinking, okay, the moons for these outer planets, they're going to look like our moon. That's what we have for a model. They're going to be old and heavily cratered. And so we go out with Voyager, we get to the Jupiter system. The first moon, Callisto, is cratered. And then as we go closer and closer, our paradigm totally shifted. Look, no craters. This looks fractured. Europa, it looks like an ice ball. What happened? And then, of course, Io with volcanoes. And so the journey continued. Each moon in the solar system has a unique personality, unique characteristics. You can look at a picture of a moon in the solar system and say, I know which moon that is.
And thank goodness, because otherwise the symphony would have had one movement. We're going to get into the symphony now by introducing you to four of the moons and therefore four of the movements. And we'll mention the moons represented in the other movements in the symphony. But before we hear those excerpts, we do want to hear about the first of the moons in the first movement, the moon Io. Look at that horror of a moon. And to help us learn about it, one of the world's foremost experts on that moon and on volcanology in general. He is yet another representative of the wonderful Jet Propulsion Lab, but I think you may recognize his accent as making him a local here, or somewhat of a local. Please welcome up, here he is, Europa Clipper Science Team member, also the author of that book you saw a few moments ago, Volcanism on Io. Please welcome Ashley Davis. So, Ashley, where does this little horror show of a moon rank in your list of favorite, your top ten? You know,
this is my, actually, it's my first and my second favorite moon. I got interested in volcanology right back in the days of Voyager when I was in high school, when Voyager sent back the first images of these huge eruptions taking place on Io. I thought, well, that's interesting. That's unexpected. I was kind of an astronomy geek even back then. This was a revelation. It shook the world of planetary science. It shook the world of science. At the same time, give or take a few months, there was a big eruption in America at Mount St. Helens, and I thought, ooh, volcanoes. These sound interesting. I didn't have the patience to be a sedimentologist, so this is something a lot more immediate, a lot more interesting.
Certainly more dynamic.
Certainly very dynamic indeed. There are at least 250, this is what we knew in 2015, 250 erupting or recently erupting centers on Io. Io is the most volcanically active, one of the most dynamic bodies in the solar system, the most volcanically active body in the solar system. Since then, since 2015, we've found about another 40 or 50 new sites of volcanic activity, mostly from ground-based telescopes equipped with adaptive optics. And what we're looking at are the styles of volcanic activity and using Io as a way of looking back into Earth's past and into the past histories of the terrestrial planets, because the type of eruptions on Io, the styles of eruptions on Io, once helped shape the terrestrial planets and the moon. This was in their distant pasts, and we see the remnants of these eruptions, but now we can go to Io and see these happening right now. At the same time, we go to volcanoes on Earth, we study how volcanic eruptions behave on Earth, and we apply that to understanding what's happening on Io.
And this is one of the most important themes that we try to communicate to people at the Planetary Society. We study other worlds in part to learn about our own.
Right. The surface of the Moon, the surface of Mars, Earth have these huge fields of lava. We don't really know a lot about how they were emplaced, but we can see eruptions of similar styles taking place on Io now. So Io is a great template for looking back into the past geological history of Earth and other places. And one of the glories of this is that just before Voyager 1 reached Io, some scientists in America published a paper which said that we've looked at the dynamics of the Jovian system, and we've looked at the fact that Io and Europa and Ganymede are locked into this orbital resonance. Mm. And we think that this could generate a lot of internal heating, so who knows, there might actually be some volcanoes there. It was the best timed paper in planetary science history, because just a few months later, those volcanoes were found on Io, and this just changed our understanding of how the whole solar system works. It changed our paradigm for where life could exist, not on Io, but on some real estate quite close by to it. And it was just a game changer, and that's just one of the glorious legacies of Voyager.
And when you mentioned this resonance to the orchestra yesterday, what struck me is resonance. The music of the spheres. I mean, Amanda,
right. Yeah.
Music.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I had the privilege of when I was invited to the Cassini scientist meeting, I had the opportunity to consult in situ with Dr. Ashley Davis on a volcanic world of Io. And basically, what he's just described is the paradigm shift and all these important themes about orbital resonance. I'm like, right, this needs to go on the symphony. And and so initially I hadn't planned on putting Moon Io first, but I've realized, I sort of juggled things around and I went, hang on, this is a really good opportunity to set the stage for the concepts that are going to be applied with the other moons, but to a lesser degree. I mean, so I think having Io position first really does get across the idea of this gravitational tug of war that is just the most extreme runaway of tidal heating that doesn't exist on the other moons, but there's a similar kinetic exchange. And so I thought, no, by the way, I think we just need to begin this symphony with a blast. So why not we just choose Io to start this galactic whatever symphony tour? So, yeah, so I felt like we need to put that first, and to really help get across this message. It was a paradigm shift. I mean, yeah. All of a sudden the new Goldilocks zone occurred away from the Earth-centric planet Earth. And I think these things are really important when we start travelling beyond the asteroid belt, because this is why this moon symphony exists, because there are fascinating worlds out there.
In conversation, Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society was chatting with planetary scientist Linda Spilker and Ashley Davis and Australian composer Amanda Lee Falkenberg. This is the Space Show.
On FM, online, 24/7. This is 88.3 Southern FM,
where you're listening to The Space Show. Moon names. Titan. Titan is the largest of the planet Saturn's many moons. It was discovered in 1655 by Christian Huygens. Actually, he first called it Luna Saturni, or Moon of Saturn. It was almost two centuries later, in 1847, that it was named Titan. In the intervening period, it was usually called the Hyginian satellite. In mythology, the Titans were godlike giants who personified the forces of nature. A Titan became the fourth extraterrestrial body to have a space probe land on its surface when the European Space Agency's appropriately named Huygens spacecraft parachuted through the cloud-shrouded atmosphere. The other three were Earth's moon, Venus, and Mars. Recently, it has been confirmed Titan has surface lakes and seas of liquid methane. Titan by Stuart Atkinson. The first time I saw you, I was 12, standing alone in the crisp Christmas snow, eyes watering with the cold. I peered into my new telescope's eyepiece, and there you were, a tiny, golden, glint, a hint, a spark of light beside the badly focused globe of Saturn. Looking at you even then, I knew that moon was far too shy a word. Centuries of spying on you had revealed to man the truth, that you were a world, a planet in all but name. Plaque-carrying pioneers and voyagers had already sailed past you, cameras clicking in the cold of space, but your face remained hidden beneath that veil of ochre-choking cloud. Our first emissaries found no Mariner Mountains poking through. Yet children staring into their first eyepieces now perceive a world of wonders thanks to Cassini's startled eyes. Wide open plains of wind-driven dunes, ice crystals piled meters high, dinosaur spine mountains scratching the sky besides cryovolcanoes, calderas creaking and cracking under the weight of who knows what groaning beneath their peaks. If I had a magic spy eyepiece, a 0.0001 millimeter wide sliver of glass, I'd zoom in on you. What of you? A smoky orange ball, dull, bruised, Halloween lantern hidden beneath a layer of vaporous haze. My gaze, drawn to the vaguely painted collar of cloud wrapped around your northern pole, a whole world rolling round ringed Saturn like a flesh-frozen skull cloaked in smoke. Yet tonight, watching you glide silently through my every night, eyepiece's thin field of view, I sense those rivers and streams of ethane swaying round your icy hills and plains. Serpentine chemicals stain ribbons of cinnamon-saturated syrup pouring into those plates of dark brooding red. Near your poles, lakes big as seas, with frigid breezes blowing weary waves across them, while fat and foul raindrops slop down silently from a sky as dark as doom itself, falling onto the fat, blood-bloated ticks feasting on your flesh. Each lake a fresh, thick tumour on an ichor-slicked kidney. In my mind's eye, I fly through my telescope's quivering tube and, shivering with the thrill, fall slowly to the shingle-ringed shore of Ontario Larcus. Standing there, ghostly titanian wind ruffling my hair, I see the lake heaving and lifting, a glutinous mass shifting beneath its curled skin of vomit-thick scum. No sun on my face, just the taste of the methane-stained rain on my frost-bitten lips and the drip, drip, drip of that dark, dank rain. Beneath my feet, brittle shingle, tingles running through me as my boots crunch down to the sounds of ice scrunching. Hearing low moans in the thick as treacle air, I stare up at the sky, but no sight of Saturn, lost forever behind the cloudy blight. One far future day, when Mars has been tamed, children from Earth will scale your hoar-frosted hills, stand on their peaks and stare down, seeking the haze, the distant dimmed lights of their spacecraft on the plain far below, and know they are truly the furthest men from home. Watching flakes of filthy Tholan snow fluttering to the foamy ground, those new Lewis and Clarks, alone in an ice sculpture landscape carved by the Michelangelo of time, will stand in exhausted silence, gulping down air, sharing their wide-eyed alien view of the new world. Titan. And shaking, gauntleted, heated hands vow to make it their own.
And now we travel to Saturn to explore its largest moon, Titan. Famous for its thick, stubborn haze. For decades, Titan remained a constant cloud of orange frustration, locking away its secret world. But all that changed after the arrival of the Huygens space probe and the Cassini spacecraft, which arrived at Saturn after an epic 7-year journey. Together, they returned an abundance of science, in which the next excerpt feasts upon and celebrates Titan's Earth-like resemblance and explores its climatology. An exotic difference to note, however, is that instead of water that fuels Titan's lakes and seas, it is methane and ethane that forms Titan's hydrological cycle. For the next excerpt, the music begins moody as clouds form and erupts into a methane monsoon. The music then turns to delight with the illumination of Titan. It's no longer a world of hopeless haze, all thanks to the spectacular achievements of space companions Cassini and Huygens.
This is the Space Show.
88.3 Southern FM.
We're on the Space Show. We are looking at, or listening to, The Moon's Symphony by Amanda Lee Falkenberg. And our topic at the moment is Titan. Hades Lakes by Stuart Atkinson. We are not warm like your soft lapping lakes. If Hades was a frozen wasteland, the shivering satellite of ours would be its hell. Colder than a coffin, darker than a blind man's nightmare, orbiting but forbidden to ever see the brilliant ringed glory of its mother, our home is a wilderness not even Muir could learn to love. We come and go, first filling slowly, then heavens rip open and rain vomits violently from the sky. Long dry rivers come alive again, full to the brim of Tholen soup that slops downhill and spills into us, bringing us back to life. But even as we are born, we are dying, evaporating away, bleeding up into the sky, withering and drying where we stand, doomed to be reduced to the mere stark stains upon the ground until the thunder booms again. Until we die, we move, as do your wind-rippled Windermeres and Michigans. But the slap-slapping of our waves is ponderous. Like slimy dough, they fold themselves over and over before defiantly crawling skywards, only to surrender and sink back again, groaning with their own weight. But no splash as they fall, just a low groaning moan as they're dragged beneath the rain-speckled surface again, defeated. Having found us, at last, after all your centuries of wondering, you celebrated, slapping backs as the grainy radar swathes revealed us in all our black and grey stained beauty, blurry tumours on X-rays of Titan's poles. But if you, who are more used to Terra's blue, reflecting plates of fish-fat, thawed comet water, were to actually stand on our shores, your eyes would widen not with delight but with fright, for having tricked from Saturn's bruised orange sky to lie like spills of silage, we puddles of methane and ethane murk are dank and dark as mud mixed with blood. No beauty here, no picture postcard views, we are molasses to your wine. Thick ichor pools swallowed by hollows and craters that cover this vast frigid land like sores on the hand of a leper. But even knowing that, one day you'll fly here and in your Tholen rain-stained spacesuits tiptoe our shores and wade out into us, thrilling to the feel of our icy floors cracking beneath your booted feet. And even though it will be hidden from your ever-hopeful eyes in your mind, you'll still see mighty Saturn looming overhead, rings tilted impossibly wide open, Titan's starry sky a painting by a cosmic Michelangelo.
Titan. That big moon of Saturn, which is somewhat less mysterious than it used to be, largely thanks to your mission, Linda, the entire Cassini team. Tell us a little bit about this moon.
Well, Cassini spent 13 years in orbit around Saturn, and this giant moon, Titan, it looks like a golden haze-enshrouded world. We couldn't see through to the surface with Voyager, and so that motivated us to go back, carrying a Huygens probe, a probe provided by ESA, to parachute down to the surface of Titan with cameras and instruments to really reveal for the first time what did that surface look like. Titan's about the size of the planet Mercury. We use it as a tour engine, so we flew by over 125 times, very close to Titan. And what we found was a surprisingly Earth-like world. Here's a world where methane plays the role on Titan that liquid water plays here on the Earth. Methane can form clouds. It rains methane on Titan. It can freeze. And so it's just at that triple point, that right temperature, to be in all three states. And so when you look at the surface, of course, it's sculpted by the methane rain. At the North Pole, there are giant lakes and seas, not of water, but of liquid methane. Methane is the gas in your stove, and here it is. It's so cold, it's actually a liquid. And you can see the tributaries and the rivers, channels flowing into this lake and sea. Also giant mountains. Ice is the rock of the outer solar system. And maybe we're getting with the liquid water organics coming out as well, that Titan is just full of organic material. Dunes at the equator, particles form in the high up in the atmosphere as methane is broken apart. You pick off one of the hydrogen molecules and you can grow longer and longer chains of organics. And these can fall to the surface and form dunes. We landed in what appears to be a dry riverbed. You can see rounded icy pebbles that methane has flowed through this dry riverbed, rounding those icy pebbles. And so we landed softly on the surface. The Huygens probe sent the data to Cassini, and all of these wonderful pictures came back. And in fact, when we reconstructed on the surface, we could actually see the shadow of the parachute from Huygens fall to the surface. And so an intriguing world, huge, thick atmosphere, mostly nitrogen, but lots and lots of organics. So we wonder, could you have life, very different from Earth life, in that liquid methane on the surface of Titan?
So Mark, I'm going to go to you in a moment to talk about that possibility, and would it be life as we do not know it? And by the way, Huygens from the European Space Agency, a tremendous success by that agency that has had so many wonderful missions. Mark, life as we would not know it, right? There are people looking into this.
Yeah, one thing that's for certain, one of those raw material ingredients is certainly present, hydrocarbons. You know, Ashley's a volcanologist, and I spent my career studying organic matter. I wonder if we both died and went to heaven, you'd wake up on Io, and I'd wake up on Titan.
Yeah.
But, I mean, even at the most conservative thought about Titan, it represents a hydrocarbon-rich world. It can tell us something about the chemical steps towards life. So astrobiology is not just about detecting life, it's about understanding how life could originate, has progressed, and then sometimes gone the full distance and actually generated a living organism. So to use a London Underground analogy, if life starts at Baker Street and needs to go all the way to the end of the line but gets off at St. Pancras, we want to know why. And so Titan may be an environment in which we can look at the first chemical steps towards life, because we know the ingredients are present, and see how things have evolved.
Titan Rising by Stuart Atkinson. Imagine witnessing this sight with your own white eyes. Wondrous Enceladus reduced to a mere dark dome, its deep in shadow south pole black as a mortar in the midnight. Of its famed plumes and spumes of precious watery spray, no sign. Its Death Star trench tiger stripes sulky, hidden from Cassini's view. Only Titan looming overhead, its fingernail clipping thin crescent, a faintly glowing scythe blade of light shining dully in the cold on Celadean night. And between the two, the silver sword blade of the rings, an icy dagger pushed close against Titan's trembling throat, drawing beads of methane blood whilst cutting the very sky in two. On next week's The Space Show, we will hear more of the movements of the Moon's Symphony, which was composed by Amanda Lee Falkenberg. Now, on The Space Show, let's have Julia K. Rhodes. Now, she was performed at the 2010 International Space Development Congress, or conference, in Chicago, Illinois. And she was introduced by Kirby Aiken of Sydney. She's going to be singing Reaching for the Moon.
We are very fortunate to have a young lady by the name of Julia K. Rhodes from Manhattan, Illinois. She's from the Lincoln Way Central High School, and she's a singer. She has participated in the Nashville American Country Music Awards, which I understand is on TV, although I can't see it in Sydney. She's 15 years old, and she's auditioning for American Idol next year. And we are very privileged that she has actually written a song for this conference. It's titled Reaching to the Moon, and Julia is going to sing for our supper in the middle of the dance floor here. So I'd encourage you all to welcome Julia K. Rhodes.
On the Space Show. That was Julia K. Rhodes performing in 2010 at the International Space Development Congress Conference in Chicago, Illinois. Well, this has been the Space Show. I'm Andrew Rennie.